Blog Talk Radio.
Brokers Chum, this is Mark Lichtenwalter coming to you live with another episode of Fundamentally Mormon on this 24th day of January 2018. The guest call-in number is 917-889-8827. That's 917-889-8827. We're going to be continuing on with part 3 of Orrin Porter Rockwell, Chapter 9 of Blood Atonement. So let's get right into this. All right, let's see here. And so the beginning of this section is Deputy Marshal Rockwell. From 1848 until his death in 1978, Porter acted as a deputy marshal peace officer of the Utah Territory to keep law and order from within the broad range of land that it covered. For the next 30 years, he came into contact with every kind of peculiar people that lived or passed through the territory. To perform his duties in that office, he brought many men into the courts for trial and prison, but he also had to kill many men, as other marshals and deputies often, of necessity, had to do, notwithstanding the reports of his critics. There is no proof that he ever wantonly killed anyone. The Utah Territory had its share of outlaws and desperados, just like the Montana, California, and Texas territories of the West. Crime was common and life was often cheap in these rough wilderness lands. It was the duty of such men as Porter to meet or challenge the lawbreakers in order to bring law and peace to those who wanted it. Porter is said to have carried on his duties with no more or less callousness and hardness than was necessary in any other region, and correctly so. Porter was a two-gun man, and he could use either with astounding accuracy. His skill as a tracker was said to excel that of the Indians. His courage in facing an enemy was enough to unman his opponents, and many were brought into this showdown. Some of the men who came out west were wanted elsewhere, most commonly for stealing horses. In those days, a horse thief anywhere was considered unworthy to live, and after they were caught, they seldom did. The nearest tree was the closest Department of Justice. The Utah Terry... Oh, it's my wife. I have to send her the voicemail. I meant to text her and tell her to call into the radio program. She gets lunch at 11, so... And I've been talking on the phone to one of my friends up in the Boise area. Yeah, so I was going to be on earlier, and I just forgot. So, oops. I'm not going to worry about it now. So, let's see. And to steal a man's horse, in most cases, resulted in death for the thief. Porter spent most of his time and energy in chasing and capturing horse thieves. But after the Johnston's Army incident, there was another toward flow of anti-Mormon literature thrown at the church. It came from both apostates who left the church and from Gentiles who sought to break the church either monetarily or religiously. Some of them went to such extremes that even their own contemporaries had to shake their heads at such ridiculous material. In most of these books and newspapers, Porter Rockwell was named the Destroying Angel, and they declared that his job was to destroy the Gentiles or any Mormons who were out of harmony with Brigham Young. Rockwell is the main character in Charles Kelly's and Hoffman Binary 1934 edition of Holy Murder. Oh, that'd be an interesting book. In the same year the book was published, a review came out for the New Republic magazine, which declared the book as a worthless piece of junk as far as actual history, as as concerned. For instance, in this book, they related the story of a man who was on a mission for the church, and during his absence, his wife became guilty of an immoral act. When the husband returned, Porter assisted him with the atonement that had to be performed. They took her out behind some nearby trees where the most brutal details of her death were described. They even printed the names and places involved. But when the facts behind the story came to light, it was discovered that the woman had lived 12 years longer than Porter, and when she died, it was from a fall off a carriage. Most of these books were filled with minute details and complete conversations, word for word, that went on between parties, sometimes between only two people, yet no records, nor letters, or papers were ever produced for authenticity. Once a man by the name of Fritz Hugh Ludlow came to Utah to write his impression of the saints and about Porter Rockwell as the destroying angel. Porter was always amused with the stories of Mormon horns and his part in as the destroyer. Let me just say. Okay, so when I was 16, my aunt, who I was living with at the time, decided to pull me out of school 1 month before my 10th grade year had ended. And she and her husband got me into this single wide trailer. And so we were living in Soda Springs, Idaho. And she did this to her kids, too. Like, she pulled them all out of school so that they could get jobs. And like one of the my cousins, a male cousin, was older than me, and then there was two that were younger than me, and she pulled us all out of school. So we got this single wide trailer home in Kaysville, Utah, and about a month after we got there, I'd gotten a job, and she decided that she was going to leave one day while I was at work. So I was working at this place called the Burger Stop, which is right by Layton High School in Layton, Utah, on Gentile. Oh, Gentile Road, I guess. Street, I don't remember. It's Gentile. Anyway, so she comes into my work one day and she says, "Hey, I'm going to Soda Springs to visit my husband and I'm taking my kids with me. And here's the key to the house." And then she left. And I was like, okay. And I was like flipping burgers in the back. And I had a motorcycle at the time, like this little putt-putt bike to get around town. And so I got home, and I went in the single-wide trailer in the trailer court that we lived in, trailer park. And there was a note on the counter that said, "You're old enough to be emancipated, and you're not my responsibility. Good luck," basically, right? And all their stuff was gone. And I called my mom and I was like, "Hey, I can't live alone, you know?" And anyway, my mom, declined to come and get me. And I remember her telling me that her, boyfriend at the time didn't like me. I think her boyfriend became her husband, but anyway, it doesn't matter. Anyway, so I actually eventually ended up living in the rafters of my friend's garage. So we put a board up there with some blankets and a pillow, and we made this, like, in between the studs, we made a ladder to get up into the rafters. And their mom let me come in the house to shower, which was really nice of her. She was a single mom with two boys, and she let, you know, this strange kid that was friends with her kids, and we're all about the same age, shower in her house. But and I kept that job, and I got another job at Hammond Toy and Hobby in the Layton Hills Mall. And but I eventually ended up in this place called Job Corps. I signed up for to get into Job Corps, and then my grandparents found out what was going on. And they found me and came down and got me, and I got a job in Hamer, Idaho, which is like 30 miles south of Spencer, Idaho, where they lived, and they gave me their motor home to use, and I became that was my first job driving truck out in the potato fields. I was the only guy who spoke English besides my supervisor, and I don't know why I'm telling you this story. I had a point, and then I get into the details, and I'm like, what was the point? Anyway, so let me just. Oh, Mormon Horns. Okay. This has to do with Job Corps. And this is the first time I ever heard this, but so Job Corps, I entered Job Corps in October of 1994, and in orientation, one of the guys that was the orientation guy pulled out a small wooden box that was lined in a velvet lining, and he had shaved two tips off of the antlers of a deer or an elk or something, and those were his Mormon horns. And he said, "Now, I know that you guys all have all heard stories about how Mormons have horns, and that is not true. We have them removed, and here are my horns." Anyway, but like this happened to the Jews too. Like Gentiles like to make stories about Jews, and Israelites, like the majority of Mormons are, and about how they have horns. And it's just a bunch of folklore crap. But like some people actually believe that Mormons have horns. Like whatever. Michelangelo actually did a sculpture of King David. No, it was Moses depicting his horns. Horns actually are a symbol of power and authority, but it's turned into something else anyway. So that's why the devil has horns, because he has power and authority over this world, because he is the God of this world, unless you are under the protection of Jesus. Whatever. Anyway, I just got something in my eye. Anyway, regardless. Let's see. So Porter's interested in the stories about the Mormon horns and his part as the destroyer. When he saw Ludlow straining for hints of truth to the rumor, he would play it up. On one occasion, Porter warned Ludlow and his party that they had better stop at his place before they left. Porter threatened them that he would take their horses away and put them in his stable. Then he would force them into the house, where he would inflict upon them the penalty of a real Mormon dinner, on page 136 of Blood Atonement. They would be compelled to eat pancakes and sausages. After that, they would be released if they insisted, or they would have to suffer such torture longer. Their release was, of course, only on the condition that they would return again. But my, this is a quote, but my butt, we are savage people. We Mormons really torture them awful with their pancakes, I guess. End quote. With that, Porter shook Ludlow's hand, jumped on his horse, and rode off. Ludlow appraised Porter as a religious fanatic and said he operated without rationality. His personal life perhaps showed threads of irrationality, much the same as everyone else in the greater or lesser degree. But Porter was a peace officer, a deputy sheriff, and he had great respect for the law and a very dim view of the criminal. His harsh life represented the balance of such a character. Ludlow marked him as a man of ordinary intelligence, amiable, polite, graceful in manner, with a dash of aristocracy. Nicholas Van Alphen, in his book Porter Rockwell, the Mormon Frontier Marshal, quoted Jules Remy and Julius Brenquist Brinkley, who in 1860 described the inner side of Porter, quote, a man full of heart and greatness, capable of the grandest devotion, ready to sacrifice himself in behalf of anyone who gained his esteem, without regard to sect or person, whether Jew, pagan, or Muslim, or Mormons. If the blood of heroes can be inferred from the expression of his face and the qualities of his heart, they thought one would swear there were traces of a lofty origin in Porter. It was a perilous service to be rendered, a crime to be avenged, or a sacrifice to be made for the oppressed. Porter was ever at hand. Pages 138 and 139. The great many instances of Porter's brush with criminals could be listed, but only a few are necessary here. Most critics of Rockwell claimed that he was the avenging angel to destroy the Gentiles, but no matter what Porter did or who was involved, it seemed that they made Porter out to be in the wrong. To illustrate, Sam Bennion was a 20-year-old boy who had been employed as a scout or guard for the Overland Stage. He finally earned enough money to purchase a beautiful, well-bred mare, horse, when his father went with the horse to a meeting in Murray. He came out and found the horse gone. We're on page 137 of Blood Atonement. Porter was called for, and he and three others began to track the animal. They continued south and then over into Cedar Valley into Camp Floyd, and from there to the Faust Mail Station. They arrived at 4 o'clock in the morning, and Porter asked Sam Bateman to check the stable and see if the mare or if the horse was there. It was. So the men waited and shivered in the cold until 10 in the morning. The door opened up, and H.J. Faust, the station owner, came out, and Porter told him, go back in and tell them to come out with their hands up. He did, but was several minutes before the door opened again, and a large man appeared with a pistol in his hand. It was Lot Huntington, a Mormon. He came from one of the most respected families in the territory and was good-looking, adventurous, and well-known. But to Porter, the law was the law, and it fell on Mormons and non-Mormons alike. This was not to be a situation much different from many others in the future or the past. There was no bargaining or compromise because of who he was or who his folks were. Porter looked upon him as a horse thief, and he was there to make an arrest. They both knew each other, and both were fearless. Porter demanded that he throw down his gun and be taken in to face the law. Lot turned and made a dash to the stable and jumped on Brown Sal, the stolen horse. As he came out, he raised his gun, but Porter pulled the trigger on his gun first, and Huntington fell dead. The two others that were with Huntington came out and surrendered. Porter brought them back to Salt Lake City and turned them over to the police. A short time later, Porter heard gunfire and ran to where he heard the shots. The police were near the bodies of the two men, and one said they tried to escape. This event, of course, disproved many reports of the apostates and critics because facts were evident that Porter shot a Mormon and brought two others into the law. Porter was not just shooting Gentiles as they had claimed. They would have changed their tactics, and they did. Oh, I'm sorry. They would have to change their tactics, and they did. And the anti-Mormon Stenhouse wrote, quote, all the bad and desperate Mormons were not brought to judgment, but the pretext alone was wanting for carrying more extensively into execution the general, police program on page 138 of Blood Atonement. Resistance to an officer or the slightest attempt to escape from custody was eagerly seized when wanted as the justification of closing a disreputable career, and in more than one case of this legal shooting, there is much doubt if even the trivial excuse was waited for. Oh, I'm having a hard time reading today. The Salt Lake City police then earned the reputation of affording every desperate prisoner the opportunity of escape, and if embraced, the officer's ready revolver brought the fugitive to a halt and saved the county the expense of trial and his subsequent boarding in the penitentiary. A coroner's inquest and cemetery expenses were comparatively light. End quote, Rocky Mountain Saints, page 419. These anti-Mormon elements would have screamed much louder if the criminals would have been Gentiles, as surely they would have been much happier if the criminals would have escaped the Mormons. William A. Bill Hickman became an apostate of no minor consequence. His efforts to crush Mormondom and destroy Brigham Young were among the heaviest assaults ever plotted by the apostates and the anti-Mormon element. In 1871, Hickman conspired with a federal marshal who was attempting to bring down about the downfall of Brigham Young and the Mormon hierarchy. Marshal Sam Gilson spoke earnestly and convincingly to the man he had spent weeks attempting to contact. What the lawman wanted was a full conversation of the outlaw's misdeeds. He especially wanted knowledge of the major crime which could be linked to the Mormon hierarchy. In return, Gilson promised to use his influence in the informer's behalf. The marshal's impassioned arguments eventually prevailed, and the desperado nodded his consent. End quote, Orrin Porter Rockwell by Schindler, page 352. Thus, Bill Hickman became involved in the plot to revenge against Brigham Young, as most apostates were doing. Gilson went through the formalities of arresting Hickman on the charge of murder and took him to Camp Douglas, which is the camp that the army, Johnston's army, built after they came into the Salt Lake Valley. And, you know, they had a cannon trained on the Salt Lake Temple the whole time they were there, just to intimidate the Mormons, because they're Gentile scum. Anyway, for the two next weeks, Hickman found his famous confessions with which was later used by the federal courts to indict Brigham Young and other church leaders. On October 28th, Daniel H. Wells and Hosea Stout were arrested for complicity in the murder of Richard Yates during the Utah War of 1857. William Kimball was arrested for being an accessory to murder of the last member of the Aiken Party, and we're on page 139, I think. Yeah, 139. And Brigham was also named in that indictment. Hickman was listed as a co-defendant. 3 months later, the United States Supreme Court handed down the decision in the Engelbreit case, which set aside all of the legal proceedings in Utah on all cases in Utah for 18 months prior to that time. This would make null and void the indictments against about 140 people, including those against Young, Wells, Stout, Kimball, and even Hickman himself. If blood atonement were always being committed upon the apostates, as some claimed, why didn't Brigham Young send Porter to atone William Law, who was the leader of the mob that killed Joseph Smith? And an apostate to boot, anyway. He was the worst of all of the apostates, yet he lived to an old age and died a natural death. Why didn't Porter get sent around the valley and wipe out all the apostates who were constantly writing and preaching against Mormonism? The most vicious slander written against Mormons came from the pens of men who lived among the Mormons all their lives. If blood atonement were practiced upon the Mormons on the inner circles of who were betrayers or apostates, why didn't Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball have Porter blood atone their two sons who apostatized and left for California? Some anti-Mormons say that blood atonement was a Mormon doctrine and was administered as a penalty for apostasy. But why didn't Porter administer it upon murderers, horse thieves, and bank robbers who were often Gentiles? He was functioning in his office as a marshal, not as an administrator of blood atonement. Conversely, if Mormons believed in atoning for the Gentiles, why did Porter shoot down so many of the Mormons? The whole fabric of critics was woven with inconsistency, fable, and rumor. If Porter shot a man in self-defense, no one should dispute his innocence. If he shot a horse thief who resisted arrest, then the law also justified his actions. If a man is shot when committing a murder, a rape, or some other atrocious crime, the law contends that it is a justifiable homicide. If Porter Rockwell did all of these, then he stands as innocent as any other man who did them. Page 140 of Blood Atonement. If he did these things 1,000 times, he is still justified as such as if he had done them only once. The American public has watched on television Matt Delton shoot outlaws on Gunsmoke every week for nearly 20 years with contented approval. They do not condemn their hero because they saw all the facts on the TV show and indictments that led up to the villain being killed. This is the missing segment in many of the clashes that marshals have with criminals. Such conditions existed with Porter and many other gunfighters throughout the Old West. Once in a court, the judge asked Porter how many men he had killed. After a little thought, he admitted that he did not know. But knowing the concern of the court, he quickly added, "I never shot a man that didn't deserve it." On June 11, 1878, less than a year after the death of Brigham Young, the newspapers carried the news of the death of Orrin Porter Rockwell. After attending the theater in Salt Lake City with his daughter Mary, he began to have a series of heart attacks. He passed away with little suffering at age 65. For nearly all of those years, he was sought for by mobs, gunmen or killers. But according to the promise of Joseph Smith, he outlived nearly all of those who wanted to put him to death. He died peaceably in his own bed. Porter was one of the first converts when the church was organized because he was a childhood friend of Joseph Smith in Palmyra before Joseph Smith ever saw the angel Moroni or had the first vision experience. They were childhood friends. And Joseph, I think, was like a year older than him, but same age, basically. And when he died, he had been a member longer than anyone else. He was not only a distant cousin to Joseph Smith, but was also a distant cousin to Abraham Lincoln. Although Porter was not the usual sort of family man, he did have 4 wives and 15 children. However, his work demanded most of his time. Whatever may be said of Porter, perhaps no one had a more profound insight into his real character than the prophet Joseph Smith, who wrote in August of 1832, "There is a numerous host of faithful souls I could wish to record in the book of the law of the Lord, but time and chance would fail. I will mention, therefore, only a few of them as emblematic of those who are too numerous to be written. But there is one, that I would mention, namely Orrin Porter Rockwell, who is now a fellow wanderer with myself, an exile from his home, page 141. Because of the numerous deeds in the infernal fiendish disposition of the indefatigable, I have no idea, and unrelenting hands of the Missourians. He is an innocent and noble boy. May God Almighty deliver him from the hands of his pursuers. He is an innocent and noble child, and my soul loves him. Let this be recorded forever and ever. Let this be the blessing of salvation and honor to his portion. Millennial Star, volume 19, page 756. And then, when we come back on tomorrow, we will read chapter 10, The Danites, and that is Blood Atonement. So I might not be able to be on tomorrow, though, because my wife has a doctor's appointment up in Utah County, and I have to leave here about 10 so that I can go pick her up from where she works at her school. She's a kindergarten teacher now. And drive her up to her appointment. So, and then I've got to go to work, unfortunately, at night, on Friday night, which I hate doing, but it's kind of the way it has to be right now. So, anyway, I think I'm just going to leave it at that. I know it's only 32 minutes, but maybe I can get my wife a call back before the end of her lunch break. So, anyway, thank you for watching, everyone. Take care, and God bless.